Support for this podcast and the following message come from Lagunitas Brewing Company, challenging the status quo and crafting stories along the way. Featuring a wide range of innovative craft brews and non-alcoholic options, it's good to have friends. Learn more at Lagunitas.com.
From NPR News, this is Invisibilia. I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller.
And today, we're going to tell you a story that we think is going to make you believe something that you do not currently believe.
Right.
And to begin to explain this story, we want to introduce you to something. A rat.
Hi, buddy.
Recently, Lulu and I got a rat, and we brought it to NPR.
So can you just describe what we got here?
It's a rat.
Pinkish ears.
Red eyes.
Long nose.
And we invited people into this room one by one to sit in front of the rat, look it in the eye, and answer one question.
Do you think that the thoughts that you have in your head, okay, the private thoughts that you have in your head, could influence how that rat moves through space?
No.
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 And it was almost unanimous.
No.
People did not believe that their personal thoughts about the rat would have any effect on the rat at all.
Because that would suggest some sort of telepathy.
Now, maybe this is your belief as well. And if it is, you're wrong.
Yes.
This is a man named Bob Rosenthal. And early in his career as a research psychologist, he did something very devious. Late one night, Bob secretly crept into his lab and he hung signs on all of the rat cages. Some of the signs said that the rat in the cage was incredibly smart, and some of the signs said that the rat in the cage was incredibly dumb, even though neither of these things was true.
They were very average rats that you would buy from a research institute that sells rats for a living.
So then Bob brings this group of experimenters into his lab and says, for the next week, some of you are going to get these very smart rats and some these very dumb rats. And your job is to run your rat through a maze and record how well it does.
That's right.
So off the experimenters went.
Can you just pick up the rat?
We actually did a very lo-fi, unscientific version of Bob's experiment here at NPR.
Is that okay to do?
Yeah.
In Bob's real study, the experimenters did just as Bob told them to do. They ran the rats that they had been told were smart.
She's sort of an intelligent-looking face.
And the rats that they had been told were dumb.
Yeah, he seems kind of lazy.
Through these mazes.
There he goes.
So what did they find? It was not even close.
The results were so dramatic.
The smart rats did almost twice as well as the dumb rats.
Even though they were...
Even though the smart rats were not smart and the stupid rats were not stupid. They were just all the same kind of average North Dakotan rat.
So, Elise?
Yeah, Lulu?
Let me just break in here and represent all the people who are just hearing about that study and thinking, like, what would what I think a rat is... In terms of dumb or smart, what on earth would that have to do with what a rat actually does? Like, that almost, to me, sounds like the stuff of science fiction, like telekinesis, like...
Gotcha.
Yeah, no one really believed him at first.
I was having trouble publishing any of this.
But what Bob eventually figured out was that the expectations that the experimenters had in their head actually translated into a whole set of tiny behavior changes. That is, the expectation subtly changed the way that the experimenters touched the rats, and then in turn, the way that the rats behaved. So when the experimenters thought that the rats were really smart, they felt more warmly towards the rats and touched them more carefully.
We do know that handling rats and handling them more gently can actually increase the performance of rats.
And in people? Because it turns out that this kind of dynamic happens in people, too.
You may be standing farther away from someone you have lower expectations for. You may not be making as much eye contact. And it's not something you can put your finger on. We're not usually aware of how we are conveying our expectations to other people, but it's there.
That's Carol Dweck, a psychologist at Stanford. She was one of several researchers who explained all kinds of surprising things that expectations can influence, like
teacher expectations can raise or lower a student's IQ score. A mother's expectations can affect the drinking behavior of her middle schooler. Military trainers' expectations can literally make a soldier faster or slower.
Think about that. As you go through the world, the expectations of other people are constantly acting on you, literally making you stronger or weaker, smarter or dumber,
faster or slower.
Yeah. So my question was, how far does this go?
So, Carol, clearly these expectation effects exist on a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if I expect that if, you know, somebody jumps off a building, they will be able to fly, that's not going to work out so well, right?
Right.
So what does science know about where we should draw the line? Does it have a clear sense of that?
No. That line is moving. As we come to understand things that are possible and mechanisms through which a belief affects an outcome or one person affects another person, that line can move.
This is Invisibilia. I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller.
And what we do on our show is look at these invisible things, like emotions, beliefs, and assumptions, and we try to understand how they affect our lives.
And today, the invisible thing we are talking about is expectations. We're going to poke at that line Carol talked about, see if we can get it to move over a little bit. And to that end, I had one question for Bob.
Okay.
Could my expectations make a blind person who literally has no eyeballs see?
No way. Expectations will not make them see.
How sure are you about that one?
Positive.
We're not.
So stay with us, and at the end of the program, you can decide who you believe. Okay, Lulu, so you're going to lead us through the story. So where does it start?
Well, it starts deep in the woods in Southern California with me and a man named Daniel Kish.
These are not raw, though.
We've been hiking for hours, and we are just sitting down in the dirt to take a break.
Could we look at your eyes?
In terms of them being out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, in a somewhat surreal gesture, Daniel pulls down his lower eyelids.
Let me just...
And removes his eyes.
Okay.
They're prosthetic, of course, and they clink a little bit as he hands them over to me.
That's so cool.
Two of the most beautiful hazel blue eyes I've ever seen in the palm of his hand.
Can I hold?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it okay, my hand?
Mm-hmm.
I think. Wow. They're so lifelike. Does it feel odd to not have them in?
Yes.
Oh, it does?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Daniel's eyes had to be removed when he was just a toddler because of cancer.
Retinoblastoma, which is basically eye cancer.
And yet he's the one who's led me on this hike deep into the woods. So how does he do it?
I think we've passed what I was looking for.
Well, he's got a cane and a hiking stick, but mainly he clicks.
You press the tongue on the roof of the mouth.
Is it kind of like...
You're creating a vacuum.
Huh. He clicks with his tongue as a way of understanding where he is in space. This is basically what bats do. Echolocation, as the scientists call it. It's like sonar. From the way those clicks bounce off of things in the environment, Daniel gets a sort of sonic representation of what's around him.
So here, I can sense trees poking up.
Now, Daniel just happened to intuitively invent this when he was a toddler. No one taught him or trained him. He just made it up. And since he's been doing it his whole life, he's now so good at it that he can tell all sorts of things about what's in front of him. If there's a sudden drop-off in front of him, or a wall, if the vegetation is dense or sparse.
So here's a bench.
Yep.
Garbage bins.
Ding, ding, ding.
Outhouse.
Wow. And not only does this allow him to hike.
So we'll go this way.
Navigate foreign cities alone, rock climb, horseback ride. But the one that gets all the attention is that he can ride a bicycle.
Meet Daniel Kish. He's blind. But that doesn't stop him from riding his bike.
You may have heard of Daniel Kish before.
Daniel Kish is completely blind.
He is usually called the Batman.
This real-life Batman.
Because he is the man who clicks like a bat.
His remarkable bat-like abilities.
And he has made the media rounds to demonstrate what is usually described as this most amazing.
Extraordinary, phenomenal, remarkable.
Nearly superhuman ability of being able to ride a bicycle even though he is blind.
As you watch him, remember, he can't see a thing.
A narrative Daniel thinks is all wrong.
Step right up. The amazing Daniel Kish will demonstrate one of his greatest tricks to date.
This is Daniel's buddy, Brian Bushway, who has had to watch his poor friend wheel out the old bicycle so many times for the media that he couldn't help but mock the whole setup when I asked him to do it for me.
And then he will proceed to mount himself on a bike and ride.
And though Daniel indulged, pulling figure eights and riding beautifully as I ran beside him with my microphone, the two of them made it clear that my amazement was kind of offensive.
So step right up and see the amazing Daniel Kish do something that everybody can, but most people don't.
And here is where we get back to expectations. See, Daniel thinks there is nothing amazing about him. He thinks most blind people who don't have other disabilities could do things like ride bikes.
I definitely think that most blind people could move around with fluidity and confidence if that were the expectation.
See, he thinks the reason that more blind people don't isn't just because they haven't learned to click, but is because the expectations that you or I or all of us are carrying around in our own heads about what blind people can do are simply way too low.
They wouldn't be able to hike. They wouldn't be able to run. They wouldn't be able to engage in manual labor.
Daniel, like Bob, thinks that those expectations, those private thoughts in our heads, are extremely powerful things. Because over time, they have the ability to change the blind person we are thinking about.
That psychology becomes inculcated in the blind person, absorbed and translated into physical reality.
And so, Daniel has a theory that if by some miracle we could all change our expectations of what blind people are capable of, then not only would you see lots more blind people on bikes, but
more blind people could,
in a very real way,
see.
Yeah, he just said see.
It's actually pretty simple and straightforward.
And it turns out neuroscientists are looking into this very idea and seeing some pretty shocking results. And we will get there, but first, to understand what Daniel means, how expectations could give a blind person vision, we need to first see how Daniel himself shot through this force field of low expectations. A story which starts back in 1967, when Daniel was just 13 months old and that second eyeball had just been removed.
Oh my gosh.
This is Daniel's mother, Paulette Kish. And a few days after taking her son home from the hospital, Paulette realized she was facing a really difficult choice.
My mom thought that I should put him in cotton.
Cotton?
Wrap him in cotton so that he didn't get hurt, so that he was so protected. That's really how she felt.
See, Daniel was a very rambunctious little guy.
He started climbing when he was 6 months old before he even walked.
And that didn't change when he went blind.
We had bookshelves he would climb, so I'd have to move everything off the bookshelves because he'd get into them.
So Paulette needed to decide, was her mom right? Was it time to start putting some restrictions on him? Or was she going to raise him like a seeing child, allow him to explore his world with very few restrictions on him for blindness? And for reasons that will become clear shortly, Paulette went with option two. She was going to banish her fear.
Just put it away. In the beginning, I think that's what I did. I just put it away.
And so, when two police officers showed up at her door,
two big, huge police officers holding my child,
having picked up Daniel for climbing the fence into their neighbor's yard,
you can't let him do that. He could fall.
Paulette felt their same worries.
It's very scary.
But
didn't make Daniel stop.
I just climbed everything I could find.
And when the elementary school called and asked her to make Daniel stop clicking...
It's not socially acceptable is what they would say.
Paulette said, too bad.
He needs to know what's around him and that's how he does it.
And so Daniel clicked. Past people doing double takes on the street, occasionally bumping into things.
It is. Yep.
And then pretty soon...
Your blind kid is not only scaling trees and fences by himself, but walking to school on his own, crossing busy streets, exploring his way into neighbors' driveways.
A friend of the family had an undersized bike, and I started riding alongside this retainer wall until I realized I didn't really need the wall, and I could roll alongside the wall without having to touch the wall. And then...
Oh, goodness.
I just could ride it.
You'd have to click way more than usual.
Peppering the environment with a barrage of clicks.
But by 6 years old, he could do it. Ride completely comfortably on the bike. Look, Ma, no eyes. And when neighbors would pop their heads out the door.
How can you let him do that?
With their concerns.
How can you let him do that? How can you let him do
How
that?
How can you let him do that?
She'd look at his smiling face and think,
how can I not?
So did anything bad ever happen to Daniel? I mean, did he ever get really hurt?
Well,
I used to have this game, get to the top of our road and yell, dive bomb! And I would ride insanely fast down the road. And everyone would have to scatter. Well, one day I did the dive bomb thing, and as I was screaming down this road, bang, I just collided into a metal light pole.
Oy.
Blood everywhere.
And this was not the only pole in Daniel's life. On the schoolyard, he ran into a pole and knocked out his front teeth. A few years after that, he ran straight into a soccer shed.
And it just destroyed my whole mouth.
I mean, his childhood was punctuated by some pretty grisly injuries. And the way in which Paulette reacted to all of these injuries was that she always let him keep going. I mean, shortly after the bike thing, a bicycle appeared under the Christmas tree.
And why, like, I am a mother, and I think that if my kid kept showing up with his front teeth knocked out, I would begin to wonder if I had made the right choice.
Yeah.
Paulette knows it seems extreme, which brings me to that reason she decided to banish her fear.
It was my first marriage. It was not a good marriage.
My father was an alcoholic, and he was abusive.
Daniel's biological father, who's now deceased, was extremely abusive with Paulette.
Sort of a barroom brawler type.
And he could be tough with Daniel and Daniel's little brother.
We had to learn to sort of take physical punishment, as it were, and be able to dish it back.
And Paulette says this is why she ended up being so hands-off with Daniel.
Everything that happens in your life has its effect. Has its effect.
She said that after spending so many years feeling small and powerless in that marriage, when she finally made it out, she vowed never to be ruled by fear again.
I mean, there's life, and then there is living your life. There is a difference.
And the same would go for Daniel. She refused to let those scary thoughts of what could happen make her keep Daniel too close.
But what if Daniel ended up being hit by a car and killed?
I asked her, like, what if a car just hits and just plows him down, you know?
But that can happen to anyone. Can happen to anyone. There was a group of four kids on the corner up about a block. A car went up the curb and hit them, killed two of them.
Yeah.
It can happen to anyone.
And so bikes were bought for Christmas.
Yeah.
And tree climbing was permitted.
Okay, I'll just close my eyes.
And this blind-as-a-bat little boy was allowed to wander the world as freely as any sighted child.
From the fifth grade on, I walked to school almost every day. I had to cross major streets. I participated in extracurricular activities. I made my own breakfast. I made my own lunch.
I mean, were they considered outside the norm? Did they consider themselves outside the norm?
I don't think they noticed it much. I don't think they thought about it much. Particularly, Daniel didn't know that there was anything odd about the way he got around the world.
Until Adam.
My name is Adam Schabel. Excuse me for a second.
So, Elise?
Yeah.
This is where the story takes a kind of complicated turn. Because Adam is basically the first other blind person Daniel ever encounters. They met in the fifth grade when Adam suddenly enrolled in Daniel's elementary school.
I will say I was a rather small fellow at the time.
Hmm.
When I was 11, 12, I was under 60 pounds.
Wow.
And Daniel was not exactly welcoming.
He just wasn't a nice fellow.
Daniel said that Adam completely unnerved him because of how incapable he was of getting around on his own.
Literally just running into walls. I mean, he would just walk along and his forehead would connect with a wall. And we'd be on the other side of that wall and we would say, okay, that's Adam. He's coming, kind of thing.
Is that true? Was it that bad?
Yeah.
Adam says he had simply never needed to get around on his own before.
I went to the school for the blind from age 5 to age 7.
And there he was taken around on someone's arm almost all the time. In the lunchroom, people brought him his food. They helped him carry his books.
I don't know why people did things for me. They just did.
And Daniel was baffled by Adam.
At the time, I had not really conceptualized blindness in that way for myself. And I just didn't understand it.
He'd come home to his mom mystified.
He'd say, Adam can't do anything on his own.
If I got lost, I used to get terrified.
Why?
I didn't feel safe.
Why?
And then what happened is that the kids at school started to mix up Daniel and Adam.
People started just lumping us together as, you know, the blind kids. We were the same age.
You were the blind boys.
Yeah. They'd mix up our names, and I didn't like that at all.
And so almost to prove his distinction from Adam.
I did the things that kids will do in situations like that.
What did you do?
He made fun of Adam.
He put up a wall around him.
I was pretty brutal.
He'd tease him in front of other kids.
I used to try to walk away from him.
And he even beat him up a few times.
I wondered if there was something I had done.
And that, in my aggressive little mind, was the thing that set me apart.
So then what happened?
Time moved on.
Adam and Daniel went off to different schools, and Daniel just tried his best to forget this vision of a kid so like him who couldn't get around the world.
And we just lost track of each other.
Daniel goes off to college, doesn't really associate himself with the blind community. His plan was to work with abused kids and at-risk kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, he happens to pick up this book.
The title is The Making of Blind Men.
The Making of Blind Men by Robert Scott.
I go by Bob. You can spell that either way.
All right. This is the book's author, Bob Scott, a former professor of sociology at Princeton. And inside this book was the idea that would change Daniel's life. An idea that when you first hear it, sounds kind of out there. That blindness is a social construction.
Wait, was Bob saying that people are not physically blind?
Kind of. But let me just tell you how he gets there.
Okay.
So fresh out of grad school, Bob got this job to conduct a huge, multi-year-long survey to see how effective blindness organizations were at helping the blind.
Yep.
And so he begins interviewing hundreds of blind people, goes out on hundreds of site visits.
Basically, gathering information in any way I could imagine that I could get it.
And then one day, many months into the process, he had
what might be called an aha moment.
He was out walking in a snowstorm in New York City when he happened to see
a blind beggar
asking for money.
Standing on the corner at Bloomingdale's.
And he thought, hey, someone else to interview for my survey.
I said, would you allow me to buy some of your time? And I gave him, I don't know, $25 or something like that. We went in and sat down at a restaurant and I said, tell me your story.
Turns out the man had worked at a paint factory until a few years before, when an accident there left him blind. And the people at the factory really liked the guy, so they said, look, why don't you go to an organization for the blind, get some training, and then come back and work for us? So the guy said, great. He went to an organization for the blind. He said, I've got this job all lined up. Can you just help me with a few basic things? And the blindness organization said, no.
Oh, no, you can't do that. Blind people can't do those things. What we're going to do is put you through a program of rehabilitation and then move you along to our sheltered workshop that manufactures mops and brooms.
And Bob said there was one sentence in that response that jumped out at him.
Blind people can't do those things.
And he began to wonder, wait, is that true? Could this guy really not work in a paint factory? Because over the course of his research, he'd seen blind people that could do all sorts of things.
This is sort of starting to open up in my own thinking a much more complicated world than I ever imagined I was walking into when I began the study.
The more that Bob looked around, the more he started to see that message.
Blind people can't do those things.
Being communicated to the blind people by the blind organizations that serve them. Not necessarily always as explicitly as in the case of the paint guy.
Like how else then?
Well, take the fact that at that time of the nearly 20,000 blind kids who were in public schools, 2/3 of them were being kept on the sidelines during gym class. Play tag, run around on your own.
Blind people can't do those things.
And then there was the organization's insistence that adult blind people get help getting around.
They are picked up at their homes, they're driven there, they're met at the sidewalk, walked into the agency, escorted to wherever they're going. Everything is being done for them.
And even though all of this was intended to help, Bob began to wonder if maybe, just maybe, the organization's low expectations for what blind people could do was in some way actually limiting the blind people that those organizations sought to help.
What I came to realize is that how they functioned was a process of learning. It was not imposed on them entirely by the fact that they couldn't see.
So is Bob saying that blindness isn't a real thing? Like it exists mostly in your head? Because my father is blind,
right,
and he is very, very limited in what he can do. And I have to say, like, I don't feel like the obstacles that he faces are obstacles that he wouldn't face if he just thought about his blindness differently.
Well, Bob would say that, of course, loss of vision is an absolute and real limitation. But it is not the complete wiping away of vision we so often think it is. It's more like a wiping away of long-distance vision.
Exactly. Anything that I can't reach out and touch.
Annalise?
Uh-huh.
Bob wasn't actually the first person to come up with this idea. Blind people were. A group called the National Federation of the Blind has for a long time advocated this kind of idea. This is a group formed by blind people for blind people, and they think that the physical condition of blindness,
it doesn't explain nearly as much as people believe it explains.
So if you buy this logic, people who are blind, like the only thing that's standing between them and walking around the world like Daniel does is our beliefs.
Yeah. You know, that sounds totally crazy, and that is exactly what he's saying. Which brings us back to Daniel. Daniel reads this book, and he starts thinking about Adam.
If I got lost, I used to get terrified.
You know, maybe it wasn't that Adam was this weirdo, tentative kid, but that he was a very typical product of a system.
You mean like the system taught Adam that he would have trouble moving around?
Yeah. I mean, he was led around school. He was... Mm-hmm. People brought him his food.
I don't know why people did things for me. They just did.
And when Daniel looked at the world around him, he thought, you know, a lot has changed, but a lot is frighteningly similar.
From then till today, things are similar?
Yeah.
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 I called around to dozens of blindness organizations all over the country.
My name is Daniel Norris, Supervisor of Adult Services for the Vermont Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired.
And supervisor after supervisor told me that what Bob Scott saw is still very much alive today.
In what way?
So most children who are blind in America don't actually go to schools for the blind anymore.
Right.
Thanks to the Education for All Handicapped Children Act of 1975, most blind kids stay in their local public schools, which is great. But on those public school grounds, says Norris,
there is a lot of pressure to keep a child safe, and especially in a litigious society.
So many of the blind students are still placed with a paraeducator, which can be good, but sometimes...
Those paraeducators can end up doing the work for the kid. And
like Adam.
When you lighten someone's load, you don't allow them to expand.
I talked to mothers whose blind kids were pulled off of playground equipment. And perhaps the most chilling thing is the fact that most blind kids will intuitively start clicking or snapping or stamping to test out their environment with sound, but they are so often discouraged.
It's not socially acceptable is what they would say.
That they never get the chance to develop their skill to the level Daniel did.
So how are we doing as a nation? We have not taught independence.
You can see this most clearly, says Norris, in the numbers.
When you look at the statistics among the academic scores for those who have impairments of any kind, the visually impaired score very high. But when you look at the statistics on how many visually impaired people are unemployed, I think it's around 75 to 80%.
The number we found was 64%.
And that's sad.
Because Norris says that's on us. From the teacher to the parent to the bystander on a subway platform who looks at a blind person and assumes they need our help.
What we are doing is we are creating slaves to others' thinking.
That's Daniel Kish again.
Slaves to others' perception. Slaves to what others think they should be doing. And somehow we're comfortable with that.
And so though he had never wanted to work in the profession of blindness, in fact, he had wanted to get as far away from it as he could, Daniel Kish decided he sort of had no choice.
It sucked me in kind of kicking and screaming.
He could see what was happening and he held in his tongue a way out. So he decided that he would dedicate his life to trying to liberate blind children. Kind of like Batman. Exactamundo, fighting for good in the world in a kind of vigilante way, because actually the way that you go about liberating a blind child from the constraining forces of culture is a little bit grisly.
All right, well, I guess we'll hear about that when we get back.
Yes, bring your Band-Aids and ice packs.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org.
From NPR News, this is Invisibilia. I'm Lulu Miller.
And I'm Elise Spiegel. What we do on our show is we try to look at human behavior, particularly how invisible stuff like emotions and beliefs and ideas shape our lives. And today we're using the story of a blind man named Daniel Kish to look at how profoundly expectations can affect us.
Mm-hmm.
And when last we met Daniel, he had decided that he was going to become kind of a real-life Batman who saved people who were blind from the low expectations of their culture. Though I have to say, we talked to plenty of people who were blind who said that they didn't really need saving through echolocation. They got along just fine with a cane or a guide dog. But Daniel had a mission. So Lulu, what did he do?
Well, he starts up a nonprofit. as you do, a nonprofit that will teach people how to echolocate.
Grace.
This is one of his early instructional videos.
It's now 2001. And since his aim is nothing short of liberation, he calls it World Access for the Blind.
World Access for the Blind.
Now, the only little problem that he runs into is that at that time, a blind person teaching another blind person how to get around is basically unheard of.
The blind cannot lead the blind is right out of the Bible. It's fundamental to our culture.
In fact, until the mid-90s,
there was no certification for blind people to train other blind people.
Wow.
Blind people can't do those things.
So this is actually when the bike trick became big. Like, though he sort of hates, look at the blind man ride a bike, he realized that could get him attention. So he starts going on all these TV shows with his trick.
You know, and my segment was between something about vampires and something about faith healing or whatever.
And on these TV appearances, he'd try to send some sort of signal to blind kids who might be watching, who might be able to contact him.
Dan, can anyone learn this?
Echolocation is a skill. Piano playing, for example. Some people may be more talented than others, but I think that anyone could learn it.
And it worked.
Yep.
Slowly but surely, family started contacting him, which meant Daniel was now faced with a question. Could he actually undo the damage of low expectations? And this is where things begin to get a little morally complicated.
The example I'm about to give is an example that took place about 10 years ago.
Daniel told me about going out to teach one of his first students ever, a little 10-year-old boy.
He lives on an apple orchard.
Out in Washington State.
I come out, and basically what I see is a boy who won't leave his house.
And so Daniel's idea was to get him to climb a tree.
They live on an orchard full of trees, for goodness sakes.
But the kid won't budge. So to get him out the door, Daniel takes away all his toys.
Our purpose was to kind of simulate the world that he was choosing for himself. So this is what life will have in store for you. Basically nothing, okay? Nothing.
And after about a week, the kid finally agrees to go climb a freaking tree. And he gets up onto the first branch and the second branch and then says, okay.
I give up. Yeah, but you know what? Giving up isn't an option. You can decide never to climb a tree for the rest of your life, but we are going to climb this one.
Yeah.
And I said, you can go up, you cannot go down. And he just had a fit, literally screaming himself hoarse. I mean, he actually jumped at one point. Like, he actually leapt off the tree. He was in such a frenzy.
Oh, my God. And what does Daniel do?
Well, he catches him. He's right below him. Mm-hmm. And he just says, no.
You can go up. You cannot go down.
And they stay in this tree, battling it out.
Inch by inch by. It took 3 hours to get up a 60-foot tree.
But by the end, the kid was doing it himself.
He started finding his own footholds, finding his own handholds.
And Daniel thinks this training and how the parents then took it on too changed the boy's life.
By the age of 13, he was out of his shell. He had joined Boy Scouts. That is in no way where he was headed.
Hmm.
That is just crazy, though, that story on some level. I don't know if that kind of bullying is even allowed in America anymore, you know?
Yeah, and he has been called reckless by other blindness organizations.
I bet.
But see, Daniel would say that attitude, Elise, is part of the problem. So what are a few tears, huh? A few scratches. He has this line he always says.
Running into a pole is a drag, but never being allowed to run into a pole is a disaster.
He worries that when you prevent a kid from, say, running into a pole, what you end up preventing them from is the kind of experience that allow for, and this gets me back to that crazy sounding claim he made at the beginning of the show, actual sight.
If our culture recognized the capacity of blind people to see, then more blind people would learn to see. It's actually, it's pretty simple and straightforward.
Daniel thinks this because, well, he says he sees.
I definitely would say that I experience images, that I have images.
And he isn't talking metaphorically here.
They are images of spatial character and depth that have a lot of the same qualities that a person who sees would see.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Laura Thaler, a German neuroscientist at Durham University in the UK. And Laura knows a lot about sight. She studies vision in the brain, literally how the images we see are constructed.
It sounds simple, but the image is actually a complex construct.
Now, several years ago, Laura happened across a video of Daniel.
Okay, so we had a little string of parked vehicles.
And as she
there.
Watched the way that on he so side. Easily moved through space, she found herself wondering, was there any way that Daniel's brain was indeed constructing images?
It was so akin to vision, really.
Okay, so now you may know this already, but Laura reminded me that an image, even though it feels like it's out there in the world in front of your eyes, actually exists behind the eyes.
In the end, the image, it's something that your mind constructs.
So Laura brought Daniel and a few other people who can echolocate into her lab,
mm-hmm.
and she took recordings of them while they clicked at different objects in space. A car, a lamppost, these are her actual recordings, a salad bowl in motion.
How do you get a salad bowl in motion?
You stand behind the person with a salad bowl on a fishing pole and you slowly wave it.
Right.
And the microphones were actually in their ears.
So we recorded what they heard exactly.
Oh, that's neat. And then she played the recordings back to them, one object at a time, while they were lying down in fMRI machines so she could watch how their brains responded. Salad bowl in motion. And then she compared those readings to what happens in the brains of sighted people looking at the same kinds of things. Salad bowl in motion.
Very clever, very clever.
Yep. And what she found is that even though for decades scientists assumed that the visual cortex goes dark when you are blind, Daniel's was lighting up like a disco ball.
Yeah, so that was really very impressive.
And the way in which it was lighting up, this is really cool. So it turns out that there are all these different parts of the brain involved in vision. So there's an area that's specifically dedicated to processing motion, and that's way over here behind the ears. And then there's a completely different area for texture.
Lightness, so how bright is something?
Orientation, shape. And in Daniel's brain, many of these areas were lighting up. Color and brightness, no action there. But motion? When they did that salad bowl in motion test, the motion area behind the ears started pumping with blood flow.
Very vigorously.
And orientation. Turns out there's sort of a grid for orientation in the brain, like a whole bunch of little pixels in a grid. And she could watch as the salad bowl moved across it.
It was really robust or highly significant.
All right, Ms. Spiegel, so I know that sometimes neurology and neuroscience
goes over my head.
Or just sounds like a foreign language that you're not particularly interested in speaking.
Uh-huh.
But
just land the plane for me.
Okay.
What does this mean?
What this work suggests is that you may not actually need eyes to see.
I kind of feel like we got to shout it from the rooftops. Come on.
Oh, my God. Okay.
You might. Now, Laura is by no means the only person seeing this result. The idea first started coming up in the mid-90s when a lab at Harvard saw that visual areas of the brain can be activated by sound and touch.
Do I have to do it?
Uh-huh.
You might not need eyes to see!
And since then, dozens of labs have been looking into just how nuanced and rich that visual imagery may be. So there's a guy at Berkeley, Santani Tang, who's been trying to determine the acuity of these images. You know, like an eye test, how close to 20/20 are they?
Uh-huh.
And what he's found is that their 75% localization thresholds indicated spatial acuity as fine as 1.5 degrees of the subtended angle.
No!
It's true! Put it another way. He thinks their world looks a lot like your peripheral vision. So imagine that you're texting on your cell phone, walking down the street. Okay, you're looking at that screen. Now,
What does the street look like to you? You know, you can see people coming at you. You can see cars. You can see trees. But you couldn't read a sign. That, he thinks, is their world.
I can honestly say that I do not feel blind.
So what does Laura say about this? Does she think that the echolocators are actually seeing?
Well,
that's almost philosophical, isn't it?
Laura asks the only people on Earth who can know. People who used to see, you know, is what they're experiencing comparable?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is Brian Bushway, who you met briefly at the top of the show.
So step right up. I became totally blind at the age of 14.
But once he learned echolocation,
just like that,
the world around him, although blurrier and colorless, appeared again.
The things are real. I mean, it's as real as looking at it.
Get like over to the edge so the whole world can hear it. You might not need eyes to see!
Wait. So Lulu, does every blind person have this?
No. And that's the thing. Laura has looked at the brains of people who do not echolocate. And though there's definitely some activity in the visual cortex, it's simply not as active.
Which brings me back to Daniel's teaching methods. The thing about echolocation is, yes, you can learn it when you get older, but it gets so much harder with age. Which is why Daniel doesn't give a damn about making a little kid cry. Because he thinks at the other end of those tears is sight.
Okay, off we go.
So I finally got to see one of these training sessions in action. We went to see a 5-year-old boy named Nathan Nip.
Okay, so what we'll do then is we'll ask Nathan's mom about parks or some place that he doesn't know.
Brian's with us too, actually. He's now one of Daniel's deputy teachers.
He can click.
And part of the goal that day was to get Nathan out of his comfort zone. But the bigger part, and really what is often this other major part of what Daniel is trying to teach, is to get the people around Nathan to back off.
Hello.
Hi.
So we go into the house.
I am 5 and a half and Ashton's 2.
Daniel asks to hear Nathan's clicks.
You have a nice smiley click.
And then we head out to a faraway park.
Where are we? What do you think we're at?
At the field.
At the field.
Ding, ding, ding. It's a sports field flanked by a really busy road.
Nathan.
And the idea is to make Nathan find his way around this park by himself.
So we want to use our clicks, and we're going to explore what's around here in this park. Let's see if we can find anything, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he finds a soccer net.
Yeah.
He tries to find a fence at one side of the park.
Well, we're in the bushes.
But gets a little turned around.
Come back toward me, Nathan. Come back toward me.
And then it's time to find
this way.
The edge of the road.
What noises do we hear right now?
A cars.
So Brian tells Nathan to walk toward those cars.
And we'll all follow behind you.
At this point, it's just me and the godmother and Brian.
Where's Ashton?
He's over there.
Everyone else is on the other side of the park.
Can we go to him?
Nathan is leading.
Can I hear you click?
Picture this. I mean, this is like a little 5-year-old boy with a tiny white cane.
Kind of tapping his way towards oncoming traffic.
Tapping his way toward oncoming traffic, which is a jarring sight. And the person closest to him is Brian, who is also blind.
Listen out in front of you. Listen into the distance.
And he's getting closer and closer to the edge of the road. 4 feet, 3 feet, and then his godmother just shoots out and grabs him back.
Okay.
And Brian kind of noticeably flinched.
Let's all try to stay, like, more or less behind him.
Okay.
Because while he completely understands why the godmother would reach out for Nathan, he said it is precisely that kind of moment that does the damage.
Often, sighted people will jump in a half a second too soon, and they rob the blind student from that learning moment. And that just keeps happening over and over again. And I think so many blind people's lives that they never get that moment of what it is to really have that self-confidence, to trust your senses, to know, oh, if I do use my cane properly and I am listening attentively to information around me, I'll be okay.
I think part of the problem is that, you know, when we have eyes, we can see things coming from further away. The whole point is, like, when it's your cane and you're clicking, like, you catch edges at what appears like the last moment, but you catch it.
We don't need to go any farther. Why? Why don't we need to go any further?
Because there's cars.
Yeah, so it means the street's here.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
What if you're a half second too late?
Right.
Because I think that probably a lot of parents, I mean, the thing that keeps them reaching out well before the half second before is kind of the specter of the half second after.
So I think you grabbed him there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What was that moment like? Well, this is exactly what Nathan's godmother brought up.
It is hard.
You know, she understands the dangers of a half second too early.
He has to learn how to make that judgment.
But at the end of the day, she is far more concerned about the dangers of a half second too late.
You don't really want to risk that.
Which brings me to possibly the biggest thing that Daniel is up against in his quest to change expectations. Love.
You can't blame mom and dad for struggling and wanting to keep their child safe.
This is Dan Norris again from the Blindness Organization in Vermont. And when we asked him if a change like the one Daniel's hoping for could actually take place, one of the main obstacles he brought up was love.
It's very hard as a parent with a child who's visually impaired to let go.
Even when the expectations for that kid are high, he said love can get in the way.
Those parents, they want to keep their child safe. They want their child to not suffer. And that's very noble, but holds the kids back.
So in 10 years in the field, how many kids on bikes have you seen, blind kids on bikes?
Blind kids on bikes, I have seen about 5.
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah, I think that we are seeing society begin to change, and people like Daniel are a major impact.
But when he thinks about the sheer volume of love, brimming in every household, on every schoolyard, and every street corner.
Are we going to get there anytime soon as a nation? No, I don't think so.
And this gets us, finally, to what may have been Daniel's one true superpower.
What most people find to be the meaning of life absolutely creeps me out.
Daniel is 49 and has never been with a partner. And he finds the whole idea of physical intimacy
unsettling.
We had finally reached the end of our hike, the place Daniel wanted to take me.
This is, like, awesome.
Yeah.
It was a huge old oak tree. Miles from civilization that Daniel said was one of his favorite spots on Earth.
Okay.
And so we climbed up it together.
Let's see where I would go.
20 feet, 30 feet, maybe 40 feet.
You're very high!
And it was there in the branches that he told me he's never really been one for love.
I was never that interested in closeness as a kid. I wasn't really a lap sitter. I didn't like holding hands. I didn't really like hugs.
He even used to have nightmares about it.
You know, a child's mind will turn things into very ghoulish, ghastly, deeply unsettling, spooky things.
Like what would be a nightmare about?
There were two.
In one, a hand chased after him.
And then the other thing were the plastic arms that want to sort of engulf and enfold and just kind of take you in to themselves.
He's not sure where this comes from. He wonders if it could have been the surgeries he had as a tiny boy, or from the way his parents raised him, or maybe he just always was that way.
Who knows?
And while he is not suggesting that you need this quality to become independent, when he looks back, he wonders if this may have been the very thing that protected him from the debilitating effects of low expectations. Because unlike the rest of us, when those arms reached out for him, he never once had any desire to fall back into them.
Everything that happens in your life has its effect.
That's his mom again, Paulette.
Has its effect.
And you don't think it's that Daniel became this way because he was in some way neglected or because it was too hard? Is there any part of you that thinks you went too far in terms of letting him be?
No. He's happy.
Totally happy.
We sat there for a while, watching the afternoon slip away.
Listen to how quiet it is.
And suddenly I got that pang you get when you realize it's getting dark and you are far, far away from civilization. And that was followed by another pang that it literally didn't matter because he'd be the one leading us out.
So we'll go this way.
All right. The end. Okay, everybody. Spiegel here again. So you have just spent the last hour of your life listening to Daniel Kish make the argument that if we all just changed our expectations, the blind could come to see. And at the beginning of this program, we said to you, you know, at the end, we wanted you to decide. So now is the moment of truth. If Daniel has convinced you and you think the blind could come to see, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, dance.
All right, skeptical NPR employees who formerly doubted that expectations could make a rat run a race through a maze, do you think if we changed our expectations, blind people could come to see?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Dance! King of expectancy research, Bob Rosenthal, do you believe that if we changed our expectations, blind people could come to see?
Yes. Now I do.
Dance.
Dad, you're blind. What do you think? Well, Invisibilia is me, Elise Spiegel.
And me, Lulu Miller.
Our senior editor is the great Anne Gudenkoff, with help from Brent Bachman, Brendan Baker, Eric Newsom, Matt Martinez, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Madalika Sika. Special thanks this hour to Joe Shapiro, Colin Dwyer, Juliana Darby, and David Gould for the music in this episode. Join us next week for more Invisibilia.
This advertisement comes from our paid sponsor, Fundrise. High interest rates mean that real estate assets are available at a discount compared to previous valuations. The Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to expand its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. Add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio at fundrise.com/NPR. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund before investing. Read the prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This message comes from NPR sponsor Betterment. Confusing eye contact with a mysterious stranger is never chill, but your investing portfolio should be. Betterment is the investing app that lets you be totally chill about your finances. No more thinking about them more than they're thinking about you. Because Betterment will be thinking about you and how to optimize your investments. Well, you'll be thinking about that mysterious stranger. Betterment. Be invested and totally chill. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest-growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.